Good evening, everyone. Happy Shabbat. And for those of us who are celebrating, who celebrated an earlier Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, happy Shavua as well. How are you, fellas?
Great.
Doing good?
Phenomenal. I do have a request here, though. It's,
Go ahead. Go ahead. I'll sing whatever you want. I'm extraordinary in that regard.
It's just to get a passage straight. Michelle, 30:21, you know, and like how it reads.
Okay.
If you could shoot that up to me in an email or something, I'd really appreciate it.
Okay. I don't know if I covered that in one of the existing chapters.
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Do me a favor. Send it. Send me the request in a in an email after the show, and I'll. Look into it tomorrow. I will, as a way of an update, since this program has been covering the more recent material and observations, kind of where we are in the process. I wrote and completed chapters 1 through 7, and am in the middle of chapter 8. Chapter 8 is devoted entirely to the discussions that Yahweh had with Dode and with Solomon, because they shed considerable light, not only in God's nature, but also in the location of Zion and what Zion means. So I thought that would be interesting. Once I finished the first seven, I got a email from IQ, who was reading them, and said, you know, this is much more difficult to follow than I suspected. And it was mainly because I was doing something I started in... I believe it was probably questioning Paul where I began the practice of putting a summation of the passages that we had considered in an amplified fashion at the end of each page break or each section. And IQ's suggestion, and I think it's actually a good one, is to change that practice and put the trimmed down, non-fully amplified passages of the whatever the section is that we're going to be discussing and dissecting before we dissect every word and do the full amplification. That way you kind of have the lay of the land, you've got a perspective on what God is saying, and then we go in and analyze each word. So I went back and I have rewritten, therefore, 5, 6, and 7 in that format, and I'm about three-quarters through rewriting 1, which is now an 80-plus page chapter in that format, and I will then do 2, 3, and 4. And the primary reason for doing
that... 1 is the faith format, isn't it?
Pardon? Yeah,
chapter 1, isn't that faith, I believe?
No, it's fatherly advice. Chapter 1 is it's fatherly advice. It introduces the book, and it also dissects the entirety of Proverbs 6, Mashal 6. So that one has become an 80-page chapter, so there's a lot of material in it. And,
yeah, fatherly advice. I got it right here in front of me. I'm sorry, I read something about faith in there. I knew it wouldn't be about having faith.
No. It's called fatherly advice. And it's an interesting. I think it's an interesting chapter. But anyway, the process now is to try to redo all of the chapters in this format, because I think that this book is focused on where we are now and advice that is pertinent for our time. That we'll have new readers that will jump in, and this book was written based upon where we have all come. And, you know, most of us now have participated in the process of yada yada and introduction to God and questioning Paul and have read them through multiple times. And so I was making a lot of assumptions that people were already up to speed at all of it. So if you tried to jump into the middle of observations for our time, it was difficult sledding. So anyway, that's the process. Well, I think when we get through at least the seventh chapter, get them all edited, we'll post them on a website and link to them from the other chapters. So that's where I am. It's why I haven't sent out new material, as I've been spending all the time trying to enhance and clarify and improve the existing chapters. Anything else that's new and different in, with you guys?
Not really. I had a pretty incredible idiot today where, you know where Sheol wishes that all under the Torah would be castrated?
Yeah,
I mean, he uses the word.
Right.
Castrated. Yeah, it's off like P46, like the oldest thing there is of Paul.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I shared this with a person who tap dances for Paul today, and she said, "Well, you need to read what's before and after that."
Yeah.
She claims
okay.
he's Torah observant. I said,
yeah.
"What the hell difference would it make?"
Correct.
You want the whole thing? I can give it to you. I told her that. I said, so wishing that all under the Torah would be castrated is still somehow pro Torah.
Yeah. Hmm. Of course, then Paul also says that I am Torah observant among those who are Torah observant, even though I'm really not, to gain advantage over them. And I'm not Torah observant, which is what I really am, among those who do not observe the Torah. And I am a Jew among Jews, and I'm a Gentile among Gentiles. I am whatever.
And I lie to gain advantage.
Right. Right. So I lie to get an advantage. So
and of course, the truncated version is, I've become all things to all men.
Right.
You know, which is pretty wild.
So,
you know?
What that means is that Paul is a fake. He's a fraud. He's a liar. So if he, in one place, says, I am Torah observant, you cannot believe him, especially when he says everywhere else that his... that the Torah cannot save, that he wishes all who were Torah observant were castrated, and, you know, if you're circumcised...
The Torah is pornography.
Yeah, you cannot...
Porn.
Oh, by
I showed that to
really
a guy, too.
Yeah,
he
also
porn.
Said that...
That's not the same thing as porn.
He called the old system of Poneros. The old system became known as the Old Testament, which he called Poneros, which is the Greek word from
porn.
Which we have derived porn. What is just... stunning about a Pauline advocate is how they can take a one line where Paul says, I'm Torah observant, and not review it, consider it from the perspective of Paul saying, I am whatever I need to be to gain an advantage, and where he says specifically in Corinthians, I pretend to be Torah observant, which I'm not, to those who are Torah observant to gain an advantage over them.
I'm with you here. I don't understand how they're.
How could you
first of all,
Paul when he says that the covenant which is memorialized on Mount Sinai, which would be the Torah's covenant, is of Hagar and enslaves? Why would anybody in their right mind side with such an individual? Why would you tap dance for him? Why would anybody in their right mind side with an individual who admits that he's demon possessed and brags about it?
I have no idea. I really have no idea. By the way, wouldn't, you know, if somebody's in a 24-hour prayer service, that's what he claimed, right? How could anybody who follows Paulos even hope to be saved? There's nobody in some prayer stance, a trance for 24 hours a day that I've ever seen in my life. Nobody. Nobody. It's not possible.
You know, Yahweh tells us that we should continually and constantly observe His Torah. How do you observe His Torah when you're yabbering in prayer?
Well, I don't
he
believe
He tells us consistently we ought to listen to Him. How do you listen to Him when you're talking?
Only one way, keep your ears closed and keep your mouth closed and keep your ears open.
It's stunning to me. I mean, that by even holding on to Paul, they're admitting they're dead. I mean, really.
And so, who was Proverbs 6, 7, and Shabbat 1 and 2?
Wondering about Sheol, pal.
Who were they talking
plague
about?
Of death.
Who was this individual named Sheol that claimed the Gentiles as his exclusive domain? What is it about this man being the plague of death that they all don't get?
Oh, I asked her that too. I said so let's forget what Paulos had to say and how I'm misinterpreting being castrated. I said, you know, why don't we look at Shabbat? I threw it up there, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She goes, well, these are done through poor interpretations. I said, well, let me tell you something. This group that I work with did these interpretations, and they're off with Dead Sea Scrolls. Now what? And there was no way.
By the way, these are not interpretations. They are actually translations. But these translations are verified in the text that presents them.
That's right.
So that you can...
If they're so poor, please point out an example of where they're wrong.
Yeah, by the way, since Yahweh in Chabaok devotes two chapters to Paul, why don't you point out where everything that is there is wrong and doesn't pertain to him? You know, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Why don't we just listen to Yahweh as opposed to get angry at numbskulls? This begins toward you, and the you is capitalized here. It is toward Yahweh. There are cruel lies and a great injustice, a proliferation of errors, which lead to death and destruction. So you must continuously withhold salvation. This is a phenomenal opening statement. First of all, Yahweh in Chabaok 2 tells us specifically that Shaul is the plague of death. So by saying that this proliferation of errors leads to death and destruction, the person that is proliferating the errors must be Shaul. It's pretty straightforward in that regard. Now, it also says that because of what Paul said to annul the Torah, to get people to disregard the Torah, that Yahweh cannot save them. Cannot, will not, is unable to save a Christian. There isn't one Christian on planet Earth who has been saved, ever. That's what this says. You must continuously withhold salvation. It was written in the imperfect. And by the way, you know, God does not say that on behalf of Yisrael or Yehuda. When it talks about their rebellion, it's always written in the perfect. It's bad. It's totally complete. But it will come to an end. As it relates to him being unable to save those poisoned by Paul's errors. Sorry. It's written in the imperfect.
I think when it comes to Paul's errors, you get so much into religion that it's you know, I mean, you whatever it is with Judah and Yisrael, one thing they do know is that Yahweh, many of them realize he's not a religious deity. You know, some of them don't. The religious, really super religious ones don't, but most of them do. Or many of them do.
Between 60 and 65% of Jews today are agnostics and or non-religious. It's
right.
Only about
right.
35% of Jews today who are religious. Now, the Jews who today who are religious have been hoodwinked by the likes of Akiba and Maimonides. But that is a minority of Jews. And the reason, there are two reasons, maybe three reasons here, that the Jews are approachable. One is that they're bright. As a race, they're bright. As a race, they know that there's something about God, their people, and the land that is extraordinary, that's worth investigating. And since most are not religious and most approach things rationally, they're far easier to communicate with than are other people.
Yeah, I've found that. Yep.
Now, that's not exclusively. And there's a lot of Gentiles now that are pretending to be messianic types and to be, you know, they're blending
two religions
they don't understand very well, combined with Pauline Christianity. But all you're doing there is it's just blending numbskulls. Lies and injustice are conspicuous to me, and they are related. You know, the thing that is the most perplexing to me about Pauline Christianity and Paul's letters is how obvious it is that what he is saying is untrue. I mean, yes, he contradicts himself, and that's the surest sign of a fraud. But it's far more than that. You know, it's not just that he says, but I, Paul, say, and never once accurately quoted Yosha. It's far more than he claims that he was demon-possessed and that he is insane. I mean, those are all pretty good reasons to toss it away. It's more than it's just really poorly written, you know, so that the excuse for most calling Christians is, well, you just don't understand.
Right.
Because, well, no one can understand it. It's really poorly written. But the biggest issue is the basis of his claim. The basis of his claim is that he and he alone was appointed by God to convey a message to the entire world that negates everything that God said in favor of his personal message. Now, the idea that God's plan, his testimony, isn't credible, isn't capable, isn't reliable, and that God gave up and chose a man to resolve that problem for him is so utterly preposterous. It's like God said, you know, this creation thing is way too tough for me. You know, I just, too many galaxies, it's spinning out of control, I never anticipated black holes, DNA, who's to make any sense of it? I mean, I went and created a three-dimensional language, and this thing is just way too complicated. I just give up. I'm going to do a reboot, and I'm going to ask one of the garden slugs out there to come up with a better plan, because I'm obviously a complete failure at this.
That's a way to put it. Yeah.
I mean, that is basically what Paul's preposterous, insane claim is. I mean,
you're right. I mean, you know, it doesn't get any worse than all that, does it? I mean, and that's really what it is.
And talk about conspicuous. God associates in Proverbs 6 and Proverbs 7 a singular man who mirrors every one of Paul's characteristics and calls him by name Shaul and calls him the plague of death. And here is Chabaouk. He does exactly the same thing. How much more conspicuous could you make it? No. Yosha, the Sermon on the Mount, calls him out by name, describes every aspect of him, and describes the consequence of believing him. He does it again. I mean, that was his first public speech. And his last public speech, which is his open letters in Revelation, he does it again in his discussion of Ephesus, which is where Paul and John fought over who was telling the truth. And, you know, Yosha says, you know, the good thing about you folks in Ephesus is that you've clung to what Yaokanan has told you, your first love, and, you know, you have not believed the false apostle. And so, you know, there you go. I don't know how he could make it more conspicuous.
Well, you know, what happens out here is people hope that others are really trying to learn. And of course, what is really happening is they're not. They're trying to make excuses for. And if you want to make excuses for that, go right ahead. I mean, you'll make
Well, how would you make an excuse for it? Not,
right
you know,
into death.
You
can't.
Yahweh, through Daniel, tells us that the worst beast in terms of a human empire of all time is Rome. Most vicious. And then he says something will grow out of Rome that will tread upon the whole world and be worshipped, which is obviously the Roman Catholic Church. And then Paul, in the 13th chapter of his most acclaimed book, one written to Romans, tells them that they ought to submit to their government. That was the government that came and destroyed the temple and then came back in 133 to destroy Jerusalem, you know, massacring Jews by the hundreds of thousands. And he says, you know, that no government, he's speaking specifically to Romans about Rome, ever lifts the sword other than for good. I mean, how would you, why would you speak on behalf of a man who wrote that? That we should submit to governments, they're appointed by God, and they only lift the sword for good. I mean, I want to puke all over him.
Well, I mean, that's insane on his face, obviously. But that isn't that, you know, I mean, that's the whole irrationality. You know?
Well, you want to talk about insane. Romans 7 is utterly and completely insane. The argument that Paul postures to purport that the Torah is dead and that it is represented by the deceased husband is got to be the most ridiculous, convoluted, irrational diatribe ever uttered by any human who claimed to be speaking for God. And that's saying a lot because I've read the Quran.
Yeah, that's a bold statement coming from you. It is. It really is.
So he says here, lies and injustice are conspicuous to me, and they are related. So he, and we know this is Shaul because he's called out by name, has been and continues to be contentious, taunting, quarrelsome, insulting in his dispute. I mean, when you say that God is impotent, that he can't save, that his testimony is pornography, me thinks that that's insulting.
Really?
Harboring hostile opposition while presenting an entirely different perception regarding the proper standard. Yeah, but salvation through the gospel of grace. Ultimately putting man in conflict with God. And so, he brings forward, advocates, and promotes strife and dissension, even argumentative objections with regard to vindication. Yeah, he has an entirely different method of being considered righteous with God. So likewise, therefore, he has incapacitated and paralyzed the purpose of the Torah. Now, I would ask you, folks, why don't you name someone other than Paul who incapacitated and paralyzed the purpose of the Torah? I worked today for about 3 hours going through every villain who ever did anything to Jews and to Israel. Because you have to be an individual that God's going to call out like this. You have to influence the things that God cares about, Israel and Jews. And so I went through every villain that influenced Israel or Jews, starting at the time this was revealed, which was in the 6th century BCE. Went through every single one of them. And I made it all the way up to Hitler and his BFF, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. I went, listed them all. I mean, I wrote pages and pages of, here are the candidates. And you know, there's only one of them that paralyzed the purpose of the Torah.
Well, sure. Yeah, and it's Paulos. Yeah, of course.
Paulos. Paul.
It calls him the plague of death. I mean, you know, there were reasons that Yahusha warned about the wolf in sheep's clothing, and then we find out Benjamin was called the wolf, and he claims to be Benjamin.
Know.
You know, and then he said right there, too, you know, can bad fruit come from a good tree? Now, there's all these people that want to say, you know, if you're a Pauline Christian, you're already dead. I mean, you're
right.
Just straight up dead.
Right,
but, you know, if you're somebody trying to hang on to what the messy antics teach, then what you're saying really is that, well, Paul's just misunderstood. Well, let's see, he's the founder of the Christian religion, and then I would have to ask you, can, you know, bad fruit come from a good tree?
Yeah.
And you got to answer.
Is
really
Yahweh misunderstood?
No, well, obviously Yahweh's. Yahweh's the one being misunderstood.
Yeah, so
here because
hence Yahweh is really, I mean, to say that Yahweh is misunderstood would be to say that God's a lousy communicator.
Yeah,
and
right.
And having translated thousands upon thousands of statements from Yahweh, I am quite certain that he's easy to understand. Now,
he ties about
if,
10 things
so
together with every word.
If it's hard to understand and it's easily misunderstood, then guess who he is not speaking for?
Yeah, take a shot at that.
Take a shot at it. I mean, this is not difficult. Lies and injustice are conspicuous to me, and they're related. So he, this is Shaul, has been and continues to be contentious, taunting and quarrelsome, insulting in his dispute, harboring hostile opposition, while presenting an entirely different perception regarding the proper standard, ultimately putting man in conflict with God. And so he brings forth, advocates, and promotes strife and dissension, even argumentative objections with regard to vindication. Boy, is that man argumentative. I mean, he is so argumentative in his letters. What a disgusting, insecure egomaniac. So likewise, therefore, he has incapacitated and paralyzed the purpose of the Torah. He failed to uplift and convey the glorious and eternal approach to vindication, whereby disputes are justly resolved. Paul, says, if you're counting on Passover to save you, you're done. If you're circumcised, you can't be saved.
Well, if you were circumcised.
Yeah, of course, that means that Paul's in hell. Well, he's in hell, but that's so amazing.
But not for that reason.
Circumcised, that his characterization of Christ can't save you. Well, newsflash, Paul was circumcised, as was his lover, Tim. He failed to uplift and convey the glorious approach to vindication, whereby disputes are justly resolved. For indeed, wickedness encompasses and guilt abounds, hemming in the hopeful. Boy, that's the nature of Christianity, the hopeful. In opposition to the righteousness, the righteous and innocent. Therefore, in this manner, his judgment regarding his ongoing means to vindication is perverted, distorted, twisted, and false. In other words, you cannot trust Pauline Christianity. Paul's letters are...
Can I ask you something here real quick?
Sure.
Yeah. Remember when you were talking about how you went out and you went from 25 cents an hour to $2 million a year just because you asked questions? You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And you listened? Remember
yeah.
That?
Yeah, I did.
Okay. This just talked about the hopeful. Let me ask you. Did you ever go on a sales call when you were, back then you were probably a Christian? And it was sort of a wing and a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't ever a good feeling, was it?
No.
You were hopeful something might happen. No. Because, you knew damn well it really wasn't going to.
It wasn't
going to
happen. No.
Right.
If you have 5,000 experiences and 4,975 are horrific, the 19 that you have laid out for today aren't looking very promising.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so that's the hopeful out there. They really are. Those are the people living on a wing and a prayer. And that ain't good. If you get down to that, let me tell you, you need to...
I'd much rather be prepared and be convinced than to be hopeful.
There you go.
Yep. Witnesses among the Gentiles, that would be us, folks. Those who are actually observant, that would be us, folks. And thoughtful... are astonished and astounded, amazed and surprised that indeed this work will be and now has been done in our days that is not found to be credible, even when it's written down and he is held accountable.
When it's written down, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how we could be any more open and clear. And, the revised version of Questioning Paul is 1,200 pages long. And, if we were to add all the stuff we've learned since then, like, for example, Proverbs 6, Proverbs 7.
You've got
7,
another 200 pages at least.
At least, yeah. Yeah, we're 1,500 pages.
Again, I people need to really, really take this in. It's really good that we're doing this here. It's really good because what we're doing hasn't been done in thousands of years. I mean, this is important work.
Do you think that Yahweh shared this information about Paul, hoping that no one would ever figure it out or ever share it with his creation? Or do you think
he wrote it all down
specifically for us to do what we're doing?
The latter of the two.
Absolutely. He's the biggest fan of what we're doing. Now, you know, we might, you know, there might be covenant members who say, you know, it's I'd much rather focus on the benefits of the covenant and what God has to tell us about our life in the covenant. But, folks, we already know who Yahweh is, what He is like. We understand Him. We love Him. We respect Him. And we know everything we need to know about how to participate in the covenant and what the benefits are. And, you know, sometimes we do spend time talking about the nature of living in seven dimensions and being able to express ourselves in seven dimensions. And it's a wonderful thing. But the fact is that we have all eternity to enjoy this kind of life. We don't have very much time to awaken those and to help those others to find out who Yahweh is and participate in the covenant. What could we do that is more important than this over the next 10 years?
Nothing.
Well, and when you think about it, the entire purpose is to come to know Yahweh. You learn a lot about someone by coming to know what they hate.
Correct.
That tells you as much about them as anything else.
Correct. But you mean, on that line, you know that had I not written Prophet of Doom before approaching questioning Paul, I never could have done it. You know, it isn't until you really understand what God hates, who the adversary is, how deceit functions in religion, it makes it really difficult to distinguish what Yahweh is offering by comparison. So,
when you read a Bible, you have no idea of these things. You really don't. It all just sounds like a bunch of religious mess. I mean, it's none of it's straightforward. It all talks in circles. But I have to tell you that the very people that tap dance for Paul and claim he was really a Torah loving man, you know, these are the same people that don't understand that seventh dimension. They really don't understand the mitzvah. They don't understand Yahweh's nature. They use terms like command.
Right.
If you're using terms like command, you don't understand free will. You might as well just leave now. You're wasting your time.
Submit, obey.
I promise you are.
Yeah, you know, for somebody to dismiss, for example, questioning Paul, because those are just interpretations. Do you know how many translations there are of every passage and questioning Paul?
Five,
right? Of every single passage, I provide one. One comes from the Nestle, Allen, and Erlinier. One comes from the King James. One comes from the New American Standard Bible. One comes from the New Living Translation. There are five translations of every single passage. Pick your poison. You know, you can't claim that we have interpreted things inappropriately to come to these conclusions, because all five translations accompany every...
No, let's see what they run to. I'm going to tell you what they do. See, this is the one thing that I would add to it. I would, right up front, I would destroy the Aramaic New Testaments. That's what they run to. See, these people are all making a mistake. They're going to the Greek when they could go right to the Hebrew. Sorry, there's nothing in the Hebrew.
No.
If you actually look at an Aramaic New Testament, as an example, you look at Revelation, where he talks about Apophis. Okay?
Uh-huh.
That's wormwood. It's wormwood in a Hebrew or Aramaic New Testament. So you see, all they've done is recopied. And it's very easy to prove. I have a note that does it.
You know,
and they've got the same he that throws the first stone and all that other stuff. It's just copied from the Textus Receptus back into Aramaic, and they go, look, now you have an original.
Oh,
there
you
go. That's the thing that they do. That's it.
And, of course, the eyewitness accounts verify that the language he spoke was
Hebrew.
Yeah. Hebrew.
Right.
Now, we don't have, you want to go back to the original, guess how many copies we have of the disciples' texts, Matanyah and Yahweh.
I don't have to guess. It's zero.
In Hebrew. Zero.
Zero.
Zero. I wish we had one.
Yeah, I know
I
you
wish
do.
We had,
yeah,
you know, a Hebrew copy dating to the first, second, or third century of what Yosha said in Hebrew. That would be great. I'd love that. And the likelihood of it being copy edited would be slim, because of the fact that so few people continued to speak Hebrew after the two Roman assaults in 70 and 133. So, you know, it wouldn't be molested like these Greek translations are, where, you know, there's more errors than there are words. But we don't have it.
I'm just telling you that's the story shoveled out. It was shoveled at me so many times. I went back and made a note that proved, look, this was added in the 8th century. This is in your Aramaic fairy tale story. This was, you know, look at what they did here in Revelation. This is 68 CE. Yours is 6th century. Look what you've done. You didn't go to the 6th century. You went to 1515. And all this is you think because you copy a lie down in Hebrew to soften the lie, that makes the lie somehow less. And it doesn't. It doesn't.
No.
As we're seeing here, Yahweh's telling us all about Sheol right now.
Larry, how do they deal with the fact that Paul never quotes Yahusha, and Yahusha almost is always quoting the Torah?
They don't, my friend. They don't. They just simply don't. They simply are just obstinate asses to the last of them. And that's why Yahweh said, I mean, you could know everything you wanted to about Yahweh, couldn't you? And if you hung on to Paul, would you be dead? According to Chabawook, you would be. Because he said, you're just sauce for the goose, pal.
Yeah, that's we are.
Your booty.
He is the plague of death.
Yep.
So this says, Rather, this is now Yahweh speaking. Look to me. Pay attention to me. Standing upright, established, and restored against Chaldea, against Babel, the corrupting confusion of Babylon, against the Bible, the country of heathens and pagans that is disagreeable and poisonous, impetuous and senseless. Now, the reason he associates this with Chaldea, which is Babel, is twofold. One is, almost every aspect of Pauline Christianity is Babylonian. Mm-hmm. Number two, Yahweh will constantly associate Shaul, Paul, with the whore of Babylon.
Right.
And so this connection is being made right here. Satan is associated with Babylon in Yeshaya 14. And throughout the Proverbs, particularly 6 and 7, Paul is specifically associated with the whore of Babylon. So that is why he has a reference here to Babylon, a country of heathens and pagans that is disagreeable and poisonous, impetuous and senseless. He makes his way to the vast expanses of the world as if an inheritance, taking possession of the inhabited places that are not his. Well, that's pretty straightforward. Who did this besides Paul? Who claimed that the world was his?
Paul.
Only Paul. Terrible, dreadful, intimidating from his decision, the lofty status he sought, the plan he advances and spreads. God's not pleased. Then at that time, he will actually go with a new and completely different spirit, exchanging the existing spirit for a totally dissimilar spirit. Yeah, Pauline Christianity is all about the spirit. You know, it's everything he does is of the spirit, where everything Yahweh says is of the flesh. It's just the problem here is that the spirit he talks about is the spirit of Satan. He will become arrogant, meddling, intoxicating, and alienating. He is totally guilty and will actually suffer punishment, genuinely enduring recompense for his acknowledged offenses. For this is the influence of his God. You know, this is Yahweh speaking. When Yahweh says, this is the influence of his God, we ain't talking about a real God here. You know, God has just said that Shaul, the father of Christianity, is going to be punished. If the guy that wrote half the Christian New Testament is in Sheol being held accountable for his offenses by God, what are the chances that there's any Christian that believes him is any place other than either dead or in Sheol? If you believe the man that God has condemned to Sheol, you ain't going to heaven.
And it's just a killer, isn't it?
It's just a killer. I mean, and it is so obvious. For this is the influence of his God. He speaks of his God all the time. It's just that his God is Satan. Are you not from eternity, an unlimited duration of time, Yahweh, my God, my set-apart one? You cannot die and cannot be killed, Yahweh, concerning this judgment is which you have appointed for him. Because what's Pauline Christianity about? God died on that cross. God died for your sins. You got to believe that God died. So what is
Shabbos saying? Diminished manifestation of God. Again, you know, that's like Moby Dick killing, Herman Melville, or yeah, as you say, Mickey Mouse, wiping out Disney or somebody. It's just so stupid.
Yeah, let's accuse Mickey Mouse of taking out Walt Disney.
Guys, you're dumb.
Yeah, good luck with
that. I did a note on that because of your statement. It's just so asinine, to believe that a seventh dimensional being, and of course the only way he can relate to us is to diminish himself. Like you said, if you're sitting back there in the seventh dimension and 6 days equates to 14.7 billion years, things are moving so fast you couldn't relate to it or even see it. You've got to diminish yourself to take part in it, or to even see
exactly.
It. I mean, really, you do.
Right. Well, it's just like Walt Disney can't enter the two-dimensional realm of Donald Duck.
No, he can't.
He can't do it. All he can possibly do is have the tip of the paintbrush or pen interact with Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, which is a tiny manifestation of an implement that he is using to interact with them in Flatland. It's all Yahweh can do with us. But the notion that God died is so utterly preposterous, not only from the Christian New Testament perspective itself, where it said, my God, why have you forsaken me before the bodies succumb, but the soul went on to Sheol. Even they're in their Apostles' Creed, they know that. But a God who man can kill is not God. The pagan gods all died and were resurrected. Pretty easy. They weren't real to begin with. But the real God who exists in seven dimensions, who is so powerful that he created a universe bigger than we can even fathom, and you want to tell me that puny old man killed him?
The only God that man can kill is a God that man has made.
That is correct.
Of course. It's just so stupid. It's stupid. It is.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same thing as saying, well, Melville got killed by Moby Dick today. How dumb is that?
Yeah. And then Moby Dick saw to it that Melville came back to life. And there's a new chapter written about a New Testament from Melville about the resurrection of Melville.
Yeah.
And what his experience
was. Herman. Yeah. Yeah. The Gospel of Herman. Yeah, this is insane. It's just so stupid. I mean, I can't.
Yeah.
Once you start thinking about it, once you know the path, it's just a comedy, isn't it?
It is. It is a comedy.
It's a goofy.
Yeah, it's like,
but don't you read that when you're reading this? I mean, Chabuk is like, what?
Yeah.
You can't.
That's what Chabuk is saying. He said, come on. This is preposterous. Are you crazy or what? And then he says, and the rock, which was Shimon Kephesh Peter, you have established to argue against and to rebuke him. You have positioned and appointed him to prove that he, Shaul, is wrong, to chide him, accusing and judging him. God doesn't miss a trick.
No, that's pretty good. 700 years early.
Oh, man, specifically. Read Acts. Read 2 Peter. This is exactly what the rock did. Too flawlessly clean are your eyes to witness such malignant and displeasing evil. You cannot endure to look upon or consider such grievous and perverse labors, this painful iniquity. Why would you want to look at and consider treacherous betrayal that is neither trustworthy nor reliable? So you're silent and still, inactive, neither listening, speaking, nor taking action, and devouring the wicked, more righteous than him. So what God is saying is, you know, I created the universe with free will. If this demonic nincompoop wants to contradict everything I said, let him do it. I'm not going to kill him. Do you want to believe him? Have at it. I am going to provide you with all of the information you need to expose and condemn him, to not be fooled by him. If you're fooled by him, it's your own damn fault. But I'm going to let history play out, and then I'm going to make certain that Babylon and everything associated with Pauline Christianity is ultimately destroyed and wiped off the face of the earth. Between now and then, I'm going to sit silent on it. And you know, after he wrote this, the only thing that he would say again was said by Yahusha, and through the chasm of time, Yahweh has remained silent. This is really the first time, I think, in 2,000 years that God's message against Shaul has been proclaimed.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing what we're doing. You know, by the way, I had a guy this week, and I hate to, you know, keep throwing this stuff off, but up here. But I had a guy this week where I explained to him, you know, Babel, you know, Babylon.
Yeah.
Bigly,
with Baal.
Holy.
Confusion.
Babel. All of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I showed him in Deuteronomy where people are, Dabarim, words, so words matter, and where he says clearly, we're not to take part in advancing or memorializing or paying tribute to pagan goddesses that I didn't speak.
Right.
And he says, you're arrogant that you would tell people not to read the Bible. You're arrogant. And I said, let me tell you what arrogant is. Arrogant are people like yourself who decide that Yahweh's words are not as important as your thoughts. That's arrogant. Do you know they're that turned around? Here's Yahweh's words. They're direct. They're straightforward. There's no way to get around that. I mean, really.
Yeah. I mean, your advice would be to everyone the same as Yahweh's advice. Read the Torah. Read the Navi prophets and read the Mizmor Psalms.
Yep.
Read them. Now, if you're going to read them, you got to say, what language were they written in? That would be Hebrew. So you might say, okay, the individual says, I can't read Hebrew. Okay, well, can you find an interlinear online? Lots of them that are free. Can you find a Hebrew dictionary online?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Can you put those two things together and consider what God had to say? Well, it takes too much time. I don't have that much time. Well, then you're not willing to do what God asked you to do, are you?
You know what?
You
could even share words with somebody, as Shimon said he did. Like you do, really. You do a lot of this work. I don't do this work. I don't claim to do the translating. I'm not even good at it. But I tell you what. I can see trash. I can spot it a mile away. I absolutely can. It'd be hard,
you know,
hard to get trash past me.
My view is that, in fact, if I could read a translation that I could trust, I wouldn't translate it. I would read that translation, and I would do the part that I like, which is to make the connections and comment on what God is saying, to share the implications of what God is saying.
Get to do that in my notes, by the way. It's so funny.
That's what's fun. That's really what's fun.
Yeah.
And it's that's what, you know, if you look at Dabarim is Moshe doing exactly that. He's sharing his thoughts on how to apply and the importance of what Yahweh said. That's what Dabarim is all about. You read the Psalms, the Mizmor by Dode. He is sharing the insights and the connections and the understanding that he's derived from Yahweh's Torah.
In the songs, yeah.
Right. You listen to Yahusha's testimony, it is exactly the same thing. He's sharing insights and explaining the meaning and the implications of the Torah, the Navi, and the Mizmor. That is what I would do. That's what you do. There is really nothing more fun or more helpful than doing that. The challenge is, however, since I am unaware of a accurate translation, if we're going to comment on what God said, we first have to know what he said. Now,
there you go.
So that's why I spend so much of my time translating what he said. And I translate what he said because I want to consider it and learn from it and expound on it and share what I learn. And to do that, you have to start with an accurate translation. It's really not any harder than that.
Can I share a little something? Yesterday I was
teaching
someone, one of the family, new people in the last year, and she's read Introduction and Questioning Paul, and she's really excited and everything, but she always asks the same question. Well, I don't know this means this and this means that. So I sat down with her for about an hour, and I showed her how to take stuff online and translate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, now here's the English translation. It's in two pick your choice. You have the New American Standard one, or you can have the King James. But over in this column, in this particular website, it'll tell you the Hebrew words.
Uh-huh.
And it'll also tell you how to spell them, even though it's modern Hebrew. And I even showed her how to transfer and translate those back into old Hebrew if she wants to.
Uh-huh.
But it says over here that this is, and then it would be something like, and we'd run across things like Lord, and then it would be over here, and it would be Baal, and so forth. And then it would say Yahweh. It's a Yahweh, of course, but it would be spelled Yahweh, and that's there. And they don't even hide it if you look.
No, it's not.
If you have a little bit of knowledge of 100 keywords,
right?
And probably not even that many, but 25 of them, you get pretty close, you know, and you've read,
right.
And you got your perspective right, reading Intro to God or something, one of these, or yada yada. And then you went to even the basic thing on there in two or three lexicons, because I can go about five or six of them and pretty much find every single word just as you...
So particularly everything you need to know is really contained in two books. Just two books. Bar Rashid. And so if you were to translate the first, 20 chapters of Bar Rashid, and then you translate the core of Shemot, Exodus. If you just translated 10 to 20 chapters of each of those two books,
mm-hmm.
Everything you need to know is there.
Yeah.
You don't need to know anything beyond that. Right, and it's also interesting that while, I'm translating Yashaya. A 100-word vocabulary won't get you very far in Yashaya.
Hmm.
Most of the words that he uses are used by him, and there appear a couple of other places, but his vocabulary was really extensive. Yahweh kept it really simple in the Torah.
Yeah,
with 100 words, with 100 words, you understand. You can understand everything you need to know in the Torah. There's 20 words that are really important, but 100 words collectively, and that's how easy this is. About 100 words, and you will understand what God is like, what he's offering, and how to respond to the covenant. And there isn't a lot that you have to translate. I mean, realistically, if you just translated the discussion that Yahweh had with Abraham, and then you went on to translating the comments that God had about the invitations to meet.
Right.
If you just did that, which you could do all of that in probably a month's time if you devoted 2 or 3 hours each evening to it,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't need a big vocabulary. You wouldn't need a lot of tools.
No.
You'd have it.
I did explain one thing to her that was confusing. I said, Hebrew only has about 8,000 words. And it was only about 5,000 long time ago. And a lot of those are just added because of interaction with new things and new people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we have 630,000 of the old Oxford Dictionary. It's probably up to, with all the computer words now, it's probably up to about 700,000. And
right.
I said, so they have so many choices, they can twist it any way they want, but when you go back to the Hebrew words, they pretty well know, we pretty well can find anywhere you look, that's what it means. That's what it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
simple and straightforward language.
Right.
It really is.
It is.
And some of the words that are so visually important, like you get a word like tzedakah.
Mm-hmm.
It's typically translated righteous,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of has a little bit of a religious connotation. I don't mind the word righteous because it is
right.
It means right.
Yeah.
But
tzedakah
means upright and to be right.
Yeah.
And so it's right, right. So tzedakah is a visual word, and so many of the Hebrew words are visual. Like even Beirut, when you look at the letters that comprise it, it is so clear that it is a relationship that is family oriented, and that we're being invited to a home.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that the language is extraordinarily graphic and illustrative and clear, and this is. It's just not hard, and God gives you his story so many different ways from so many different perspectives, and it's always the same. You know, it's just a different angle to look at the same testimony or a restatement of it, and so it just builds your knowledge. So then God says, upon my requirements, this is amazing. Upon my requirements and responsibilities, I've decided I will literally and continually stand. And I will choose to present, always stand and present myself upon that which protects and fortifies. So God is saying, you know, okay, here's that Pauline Christianity that says that that there's a new God and a new testament and a new covenant with entirely different basis. But God is saying, upon my requirements, what are God's requirements? And by the way, he has requirements beyond the covenant, which is five in the covenant. He has the seven requirements that we listen to and answer his invitations to meet with him seven times a year. He requires that we do not diminish the importance of his name.
And those three in the first tablet, pretty big.
Right.
That's right there in the mitzvah. I mean,
right. That you don't add to or take away from the Torah. I mean, there's some requirements that he has. But he says, but you know that those requirements are not just binding on us, but on God.
Mm-hmm.
And God says, okay, upon the requirements that I've laid out, I'm going to take my stand. I'm going to continually stand relative to those requirements and my responsibilities. You know, and when it comes to Yahweh, he has some serious responsibilities. We don't have many. And answering his invitations and responding to the requirements of the covenant are pretty minimal stuff. But
the requirements he makes to give us what we're going to get is nominal.
Yeah.
I mean, there's greater requirements to get hired as a job applicant somewhere.
Yeah, we have to kind of show up and get the present.
We do. We have to show up and get the present. We have to pay attention.
Do you understand what I'm saying here? I've told people this 100 times. It's just, he's not really, you know, we have to rely on the work he did, and we have to realize. I mean, I think that's part of what the whole mitzvah is about, is to learn his nature, don't you? I mean,
his plan. Yeah. He likes it. He's proud of it.
Yeah.
He's done all the work, but
yeah, he's not changing as
well.
I'm impressed. On my responsibilities and my requirements, I have decided I will literally and continually stand, and I will choose to always stand and present myself upon that which and fortifies. So then, I will be on the lookout in order to see what he says about me. Because then, how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking, or my response concerning my disapproving rebuke?
Now, if you read that in a Bible, if you read that in a Bebel, a confused Bebel, It never would have came across that way, and you even wouldn't even have known what the hell is even being said there. Would you?
No. Oh, no. Yeah, the Mission Earth would probably be Mike Commands. And,
well, that would certainly
and, yeah, and I have decided I will literally continually stand as Ahmad. I will always be present, actually standing, and thereby generally enable others to consistently stand. I wouldn't be communicated that way, even though it's written with the call stem, which addresses actual events, which are to be interpreted literally, and the imperfect conjugation, which reveals that God's presence will continue throughout time. And then in the cohortative mood, which is the expression of volition in the first person. You know, it's all there, but they would just pass over it. And then God says, I'm going to be on the lookout in order to see what he will say about me. So how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking, or my response, and my disapproving rebuke? You know, Proverbs 6...
And he's talking about a he here.
Right. Proverbs 6 goes through, and it details the characteristics of Paul. And then it says, these six things, or these seven things I hate, and seven are an abomination to me, and it's all those same seven things that he just presented that he despises about Paul. And all the way through, and there and in here, it's a singular masculine individual. One person. And he names the person by name, both in the Proverbs and here in Chabaok. This is not hard. Then Yahweh answered, approaching me, and he said, write this revelation, and then expound upon it and reiterate it using those letters upon writing tablets, so that by reciting this, he might run and go away. Now, Chabaok 2:2 is something that Paul, people identify with Paul, because Paul says in his Galatians that he was running away. You know, I'm running. Am I running in vain? You know, and he's
running.
And people make the connection here, and this that he may run, and Paul's claim to be running. So people know that there is a connection between these two.
Yes, indeed.
But Yahweh answered and approached me.
They just completely twisted.
Write this down. You know, write this down. Why? I want you to write it down so that by reciting this, you know, he might go away. Well, we're doing
well, yeah, that also what's Paul known for. I mean, come on. They won't say, well, you know, he wrote some letters. They go, his epistles. And you go, you know, I remember being in church and as well, it was an epistle. Well, that's a letter. And I'm going, a guy wrote letters. I mean, that...
And your religion is based on a guy's letters.
Yeah. Yeah. And in Timothy's case, obviously, love letters, man. I never got that. The whole holy kisses and all this nonsense till I read Chabaok, where it turns out he likes looking at other men's genitals. And I was like, wow, those are love letters.
I'm going to tell you, I don't share the same fascination. Okay. Still indeed. This revelation from God is for the moed, appointed meeting times.
Boy,
it provides a weakness
that's
a witness and speaks. Yeah, pouring out evidence in the end. The extended period of time required for this question to be resolved shall not prove it to be false. Expect him in this regard, because indeed he will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering.
Yeah, so expect him to be there during the fulfillment of the Moed, the three Moed Mekra, which is
right.
What Yahusha did in 33 CE,
right.
When Paulos was in rabbi school. Well, clerical school. I guess they didn't have rabbis then. They had, Sadducees and Pharisees.
So, this revelation was for the time of the Moed, when they were being fulfilled in 33 CE, Roman pagan calendar time, 4,000 So it is, with speaking of what's going to happen then, but the witness that we're providing here, that Yahweh is providing through Chabaok, is actually speaking out, pouring out evidence in the end. That means today.
That's free.
Right. That this was written about what would happen at the time the Moed were being fulfilled, but it would be used in the end.
Yeah.
God is thinking about what we're doing. He's predicting exactly what we're doing. The extended period of time, well, you know, I don't think there's any other place where God says there's an extended period of time. And to come to find out the extended period of time is 666 years. From the date that this was written to the time that Paul authored his first letter was 666 years. The only time he says, hey, you know, extended period of time. When I read that, I said, well, I should probably figure this out. How long was that period of time? I said, 660. Oh, good grief. Expect him in this regard, because indeed he will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. And he did. He was right there. You know, like ugly and a monkey, right there. Pay attention.
He's all over it, wasn't he?
Oh, man, he was all over it. I mean, when you read Galatians, I mean, he stepped into it with both feet. Pay attention. He will be puffed up with false pride. You know why it's false pride? Because Paul was grotesquely insecure.
Yeah.
He knew he was a pile of crap. He knew it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, he knew. He knew he was a total dick. And I tell you something about
that. Yeah, he was.
Now. He reminds me. The people that follow him remind me of him. They really do. Everything about them is read your Bible.
Puffed up. Puffed up.
So, wow. How are you going to throw men's words at me that are named after a sun goddess? How could you possibly do that when I've shared these words with you?
Yeah, why don't you tell me where Yahweh says that he has a Bible, and why don't you look at the closest Hebrew word? And there's one Hebrew word that's written identical to the Bible, Babel. And that word is introduced often. And what does God say about it? He says it means confusion. It means to provide confounding language. It means that it's associated with Bel, the Lord. It means it is in association with what grew out of Babylon. And
well, the Bible is in certainly association with the Lord, isn't it?
Yeah, but if you've got one of those, you're in trouble.
Yeah, you are.
You're in real trouble.
It's trash. Trash.
It is.
They should all be burned. They should all be burned.
They are so misleading, they ought to be burned. Well, that's not to say that I can't even say the basis of the Torah, Nabi, and Mizmor should be read, but the problem is that the basis of Christian Old Testament translations is the Latin Vulgate. That's just the way it is. It's not the Hebrew. Pay attention. He was puffed up with false pride. His soul is not right or straightforward. He does not consider anything appropriately and is circuitous in his reasoning. He wanders away by twisting and convoluting the teaching, and nothing is on the level with him. Boy, isn't that a truth? I mean, that is the thing that you come to is you try to look at Paul's arguments that he lays out. They're all circular reasons.
Who talks in a total circle about everything? He doesn't want to be nailed down to anything. You know, Dee had she's a member of our group, her and John, and Dee Powers was telling me that her stepfather, who basically used them as slave labor when they were adopted, was a preacher, and he prided himself on opening up his church 6 days a week and having people come in and ask him any question. And she said he was a master of talking in circles.
Yeah.
That's what he could do. He could talk in circles.
Circular reasoning is one of the flaws of logic, and Paul was most guilty of that. So then, through trust and reliance, those who are righteous and vindicated, tzedak, shall live. And so this condemnation of Paul is then quoted by Paul twice. That's how blatant and ballsy Satan is. First, it's in Galatians 3:11. It says, but because with regard to the Torah, absolutely no one is vindicated or justified by God, becomes evident because those who are righteous out of faith shall live. So Paul wrote, because with regard to the Torah, absolutely no one is vindicated or justified by God. And that becomes evident because those who are righteous out of faith will live. Well, that's not what God says. And it's the opposite of what the Torah claims. And then Paul, and that was Galatians 3:11. Then in Romans 1:7, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from belief to belief, as it has been written, the righteous shall live by belief. The words that God wrote, he says, so pay attention, he will be puffed up with false pride. His soul is not right or straightforward. He uses circular reasoning, convoluting the teaching. So then, as a result, it's through trust and reliance, ba'amuna, by being firmly established, confirmed, and upheld by that which is dependable and steadfast, always truthful and reliable. Those who are tzedak, right, righteous, vindicated, innocent, shall live.
You know, can
there
I
is no
throw something in?
Comment on faith here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, where you write in here, his soul is not right and straightforward, and we're condemning him. That's the subject. And then it goes through, and then you rightfully say, then through trust and reliance or endurance, trustworthiness, whatever. Those who are righteous and vindicated, which makes sense. The
right.
King James and the New American Standard say this, and it's so confusing. Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, which is correct. They're talking about Paul.
Uh-huh.
But he is righteous, but the righteous will live by his faith. You know how they just it's just a little.
Yeah, because now it's saying that by his faith would be the faith of the one that is
right.
Arrogant.
But he's just condemned, and that's just
right.
You know,
right.
Come on, Frank.
Come on, folks. There are those who would say that Chabaouk 1, 2, and 3 is condemning Babylon somehow in Chaldea, therefore Satan, and that it is condemning of this thing, and that it's Sheol, not Shaul. So I would say, is there any possibility that Sheol, which is a place, has a soul?
No.
No. Is there any chance that Babylon, which is
a human being,
has a soul?
Place. The places don't have any of that stuff. So.
Right.
No. So you can't get there that way.
You can't get there. No,
he speaks in circles.
Yeah. Sheol doesn't speak.
No.
Sheol doesn't have an ego. Sheol doesn't claim to be appointed to speak to the Gentile world. Sheol did not arrive on when the Moed were being fulfilled.
Not at all.
No. Nor did Babylon. But Paul did.
Yeah. I mean, that's not even, you can't even argue that.
No.
I mean, that's not even a...
And to think that in Galatians 3:11, the pivotal position, I mean the fulcrum of all of Pauline Christianity is presented in Galatians 3:11. It is the passage that the pastors in New Zealand were citing to prove that the Torah was over, that it was a done deal on the radio in New Zealand that caused our good friend Dode, our Kiwi farmer.
I know Dode.
Say, obviously, one or two things is true. Either they're misquoting Paul, or what Paul said is untrue. You know, would you look into it? Well, you know, 1,200 pages letter with questioning Paul, we figured that one out. But this is the place that it all falls apart, that where Paul deliberately misquoted the prophet who was exposing and condemning him. I mean, I don't know how you get to a more linked, connected condemnation than when the person being condemned misquotes what was said about him. to actually create the fulcrum upon which his religion is predicated. Then it goes on to say, moreover, because of the intoxicating wine and inebriating spirit of the man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal, he is a high-minded failure. He will not rest or find peace nor live. Whoever is open to the broad path associated with Shaul.
He he said
are like the plague of death. But, you know, it's a lot more than him just naming Shaul. And for those who say, well, why do you think that Shaul is Paul? Well, you know, Paul three times gives the account of what happened on the road to Damascus. And all three times he says that flashing spirit called him Shaul, Shaul. There is no question that his name was Shaul.
Shaul.
And you know, there's only two.
Yeah, they Shaul. Say Saul, don't they? They always say Saul. When it's Shaul.
Right, but Saul, they know the name is Shaul. And that it says here that he's intoxicating. When Yahweh speaks of intoxication, he's always speaking of demonic spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Intoxicating, inebriating spirits. Of the man of deceptive infidelity. Now, the man of deceptive infidelity, we would think, would be the Torahless one, called the Antichrist by Christians, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is the spirit of deception. You just said that this person has an intoxicating spirit. So now this would be a man, and by the way, it's Gerber. Gerber is an individual human being, a Gerber. So this is a man with an intoxicating spirit. Now, and it is very possible, and I think this is the case, that the spirit, the intoxicating and inebriating spirit, is of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal. So this man was possessed by a spirit that is deceptive and treacherous, is what caused him to be a high-minded failure, an arrogant, meritless, presumptive failure. And then, so, first of all, we've identified this is Paul. And it explains that Paul was demon-possessed. But then it says that for all of those who are open to his broad path, didn't Yosha speak about the broad path that leads to death and destruction when he
sure
was...
did.
Emphasizing the problems associated with religion, and particularly the religion that annuls and discredits the Torah. He says, you know, that's the broad path that leads to death and destruction. Well, he didn't make it up. He was citing Chabaouk. And he even said that broad path, which was specifically presented in Matanyah as the broad path that leads to death and destruction, was the path that annulled the Torah. And now he's associating that broad path with Shaul. Every connection you need is laid out right before you. He and his soul, so it's not Shaul, because Sheol does not have a soul,
nope.
The plague of death. And so God is saying that anyone who's open to Pauline Christianity, if you're open and receptive to Pauline Christianity, you will not live. You will not find peace, shalom. You will not find rest. 100% of Christians have either died or they are going to be destined to an eternity in Sheol. And so those who are brought together by him, accepting him, will never be satisfied. Almost every Gentile will gather together unto him, all of the people of different races and nations. 2.4 billion of them. And it's beyond the 2.4 billion of them because Western society is so influenced by them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have political practice in there even.
Yeah,
you do. You're really
so there you are. And so those who are brought together by him, accepting him, will never be satisfied. So God has said, I am never going to save. There is no satisfaction in Christianity. It is nothing but false hope.
And by the way, if you're a messianic or somebody joining the fence-setting crew that has, mm-hmm. you know, kind of a foot in two different religions as opposed to being like Abraham and walking out of a religious place, you're dead, because it says so right here.
Yeah,
you're accepting him, you're dead. You're dead.
Now,
dead.
I want you to tell me how many people known named Shaul managed to convince most Gentiles to believe him.
I only know of one. Period.
In fact, I would like to ask you,
I don't think
any name, by, any name,
tried.
By any name of all time, that got most Gentiles or an enormous quantity of Gentiles to believe him.
None.
Except Paulos.
Yeah,
you know,
none.
I mean, that's the end of the line right there. That's a good question, by the way. Very good point.
Yeah. By the way, in 1 Corinthians 11, 20 and 21, Paulo specifically tells those who have joined his assembly not to participate in Passover, which is the ultimate plague of death, and not to drink wine in association with it, which thereby nullifies the symbolism associated with the blood of the Passover lamb. It's about as treacherous a betrayal as you could possibly concoct.
And you really can't get literally more of the plague of death than avoiding Passover, which is the solution to death.
That is correct. And so that's why I wanted to make the point, is that Paul specifically told his believers not to participate in Passover. And that is the plague of death. The moment you think that Passover is about God dying, as opposed to the sacrificial lamb opening the doorway to life, the moment you make that mistake, it's over for you. That's the plague of death. There's only one route to life. It's Passover. And so anything that annuls Passover is a plague of death. Paul not only annulled Passover specifically, but everything in the Torah, which is the only place that presents what Passover represents. This is also amazing. Shaul means question him. They do not ask questions, any of them, about him. Terse references to the word they lift up as taunts to ridicule. You know what happened as you were engaging in the Pauline advocate today, Larry? You know, she said, "Oh, well, you know, you got to read it in context." Just before that, he said he was Torah observant. Terse references to the word they lift up as taunts to ridicule.
Yeah. I don't care what he said before it. I don't care. Once you say that somebody under the Torah should be castrated, I don't care what you said before that. That's like a guy that says, "But," you know.
Yeah. I only care what you said before that. If in fact it helps me prove emphatically that you ought not trust him. And if you're advocating him, then I don't care. But if you're somebody who has got an open mind and says, "Could you resolve this for me?" Okay. I'd be happy to do so, you know. And the line of "I'm Torah observant," you have to view from the Corinthians proclamation that I just pretend to be whatever serves my interest, even though I'm not these things. And there you go. And but you'd also say, well,
I mean, what
you observant,
just said,
how can somebody who's Torah observant say don't observe Passover?
How many people?
Be Torah observant,
well,
and not
she'll say that was a rewrite. She'll say that was a rewrite. They run right to their Aramaic. We have proof in the Aramaic. You know, I mean, these people aren't looking for the truth. They're looking to defend a lie.
So in the Aramaic, Paul is no longer the plague of death. So the Aramaic nullify Yahweh's prophecy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, apparently. I mean, I showed her Chaba book, and she said, "Oh, well, these translations are purposely misleading." I said, "No, they're very highly accurate.
Yeah,
ESS, dear.
You
know, if you want to show me what word's wrong, we can debate it if you'd like. You know, I mean, I lay that right out to them. Show me the word that's wrong.
Yeah, show me the
show
word.
Show it to me.
Right. Yeah, tell me that Malitzchak, which is elusive words and mocking interpretations, show me that it does not mean derisive words wrapped in enigmas and arrogantly spoken. No. Come up with a different definition if you want to say that's not what it says.
I mean, what you just said, how many people do you know named Sheol that many Gentiles from all over the world follow? Name one. In history.
Yeah.
In all of history.
Right. And in that context, it says that he's the plague of death.
Absolutely.
So it's not only that he alone fits the bill, it's just that the bill is a death warrant. You ought to care about that. There are hard and perplexing questions that need to be asked of him. So they should say, "Woe to the one who claims to be great so as to increase his offspring, acting like a rabbi," neither of which apply to him. For how long will they make pledges based upon his perceived significance?
Now, isn't that what they do? They go to church and give money and pledge, right. Make pledges, right. Oaths, and every other
right.
damn
yeah.
thing.
Of course. Yeah.
Yep.
Based upon the significance of Paul's letters.
Yep.
And yet they
not
never
based
question
upon the Torah. That's right.
No, there isn't a single Christian that questions Paul. Once you start to question Paul, you can't say you can't remain a Christian.
Oh, they'd boot your ass out of the circus. You know that.
Oh, yeah, well, you'd leave just by the by doing that.
Well,
but,
sure.
You know, here's his name is question him, and God says there are hard and perplexing questions which need to be
yeah,
asked.
Yeah, we'll talk about a barb. They don't even
right,
question
yeah.
him, and his name yeah. means question him. Oh, gotta love that.
It's kind of funny. He loads himself down with thick mud. So why not quickly, for a short period of time, rise up and take a stand? You know, it wouldn't have taken much to show this man is filthy. It really wouldn't have taken much. And Christianity would never have existed. But unfortunately, very few people take the time to deal with the mud that he tracked.
Even back in the day, there was so much Gnosticism and nonsense. I mean, every other
right.
person wanted to be a spiritualist or a Gnostic.
Well, of course.
That's how he got away with it.
Right.
That's
well,
exactly
course,
how he got away
well,
with it.
Y'all
got to
remember,
and,
the Romans wiped out all
Dionysus
the too.
Religion and mix them all together, and little Roman religion and politics. What the resulting brew was, of course, highly desirable because it mirrored everything that they had already been misled to believe.
Sure, sure. What did you say, sir?
No, I'm just saying, you know, at that period of time, and Paul, after Paul, they started destroying all the Romans were destroying all the Torahs up to 133.
Right.
So if you want to say, well, you go look to the Torah, it's where you want to find it if you don't want to get burned up with it.
Yeah,
so
well, you know, the Torah wasn't really burned until...
Well, no, but, I mean, they wrapped people
yeah.
up with them. They would kill you if you had one.
That was in 133 that Hadrian did that. Now,
so,
is there a possibility
forward,
that in 70 it happened as well? Yeah, it could well have been.
Yeah.
Certainly,
so
we know that the rabbis, because it's recorded in the Talmud, tried to destroy copies of the testimony of the eyewitness account of Matanyahu. And so it was the rabbis that hunted them down. And they have a whole discussion about what do we do with it, because it has
Yahweh's
the name,
name
of Hashem. It has Yahweh's name. It was written all over in Matanyah in Hebrew.
And they burned
and so
them.
The rabbis are discussing about, we need to destroy these, but how do we destroy them? Because they've got Yahweh's name in it, and we've made a pledge that we wouldn't destroy something that has Yahweh's name, but well, we've got to destroy this because it's just devastating to our religion. And so there's whole discussions in the Talmud on how to deal with the Hebrew text of Matanyah. So the rabbis
destroyed
that.
Why did they destroy
that.
It? I thought they burned them. Maybe
they did.
I
well,
they
that was their. That was what they finally came up with, even though that was in opposition to their religious doctrine, which the reason we have the Dead Sea Scrolls is because rabbinical types and religious Jews were of the belief that if something had Yahweh's name in it, that you could not destroy it. And so they put, when they became too old and fragile to be used, they took the documents, the Torah, the Nabi, and Mizmor, that contained
that's
Yahweh's name, and they
yeah.
put them into these stationary jars.
Right.
So that's the reason we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so as the rabbis were discussing Matanyah, it was written in Hebrew, they're saying, you know, it's got Yahweh's name in it, so we should do the same thing. We should, you know, bury it in clay jars, but we don't want to give it that kind of treatment because this is so in opposition to our religion. So what are we going to do about it? Can't let them stay. We can't bury them in jars, so what are we going to do? And they decided they just burn them. And then later, in 133, Hadrian came up with a brilliant idea that why don't we just soak the Torah in water and then douse the those who could read Hebrew in petroleum as pitch was available at that time, and then we'll slowly roast them alive, killing both the person who could read Hebrew and the documents written in Hebrew.
How do you think an effective method for the devil?
Yeah. Oh, I know. Yes. Yeah. I personally think that Hadrian is in Yahweh's most despised three. Yeah. You know, if you were to take who does God hate the most, well, it's clearly far and away the person God hates the most of everyone
Paul.
Who's ever lived is Paul. Yeah, Paul. Paul is a runaway winner of the most hated man in human history. And then it's a question, and I think it's Muhammad comes in second. And I think it's Hadrian comes in third. And then after Hadrian, you've got other considerations for the top five. Rabbi Akiva, Maimonides would be in that race. Vespasian and Titus would be in that race. Adolf Hitler could possibly be in that race. To be in a considered to be worst 10 of all time, yeah. The Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Muhammad al-Husani, could be in the top 10 most hated. Constantine and Theodosius, the guys who perpetuated the transition from the empire of Rome to the Roman Catholic Church. But top of the
what about going back to like ancient Babylon and like Semiramis and Tammuz?
Yeah, I guess you could
they kind of created the foundations of.
No, but they didn't attack Israel immediately.
No, they didn't. They're all going to
get to know one another real well.
Yeah, you know it's interesting that the name for. Nin, who was the son that was the Nimrod of first Babylon. That you know, his name is still known because there's the Nineveh province in Iraq. So you know, there's still a legacy of who he was. So yeah, I would say that you're right. You could have Nimrod. And Semiramis be in the top 10. Yeah, all those are definite possibilities. Those would be the fun trials to attend.
Yeah, you know what? If you make Sheol, it doesn't really matter.
Well, I mean,
first or tenth.
As one of the things I've asked for many, 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 many times, I want to be a witness at the trial of Sheol. I would like to be a witness at the trial of Muhammad. I would really, really like that. But, you know, there's parts of me that says, okay, you've done enough talking. Wouldn't it be fun just to listen to Yahweh make his case? Yeah, it would be. But
I want to watch the trial. I don't know if I want to give testimony, but I definitely want to watch those trials.
Yeah, I want to be there when Hadrian is tried. Yep, I do. You know, Hadrian, it's interesting. Hadrian actually wrote an autobiography. It's been lost to time. But he ended his life writing poetry. Most of his poetry, of course, was his expressing his love for he had a gay sex toy that he traveled around the world with, and most of his love was expressed for his twisted little friend.
That's you know, there seems to be a theme with these people that are follow the beast. You know that.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean,
even Muhammad,
he had a
harem of women. Women were to abuse. I mean, he used a harem of women strictly to abuse these women. And he wrote specifically about how homosexuality would be no longer treated as a stigma in Allah's paradise. So,
he got the great descriptions of the young boys in Allah's brothel.
Yeah. You know, Hitler was really twisted in terms of his sexuality.
Yep.
So I think it's quite common. Paul was twisted in his sexuality. I think it's pretty common with these boys that it is a common trait, and their mistreatment of women and their adoration of men is all something that is that reveals an aspect of their character.
Yeah, and it's a really weak character because, and that's why there is always an attack on women, and women are to not be sexy. Women are to be covered and sort of barefoot and stupid and cooking for everybody and that kind
all
of
that
thing.
All that Puritan stuff.
Yeah. I mean, this is what happens.
Well, we have made it to a wonderful spot, and what I think is the most revealing, precise prophecy in the whole of the Nabi prophets. So why don't we pick this back up next week in the same spot, and we'll continue through Chabahu.
Sound like a plan?
Yep. After that, we're going to have two chapters that deal expressly with Yashaya, and the opening two chapters of Yashaya are extraordinarily revealing. So we have a lot of material yet to cover it. And it appears that I'm going to be able to stay ahead of it, even though I've backtracked a lot to try to rewrite some of this. But
I really love the new format. I've been going back through it now, and I really like this format. It helps and it flows, and it's just really accessible.
Yeah, that's one of my.
Well, I mean, that does count. A lot of times when I'm doing a note, I got to take those out. I can do it to where the dark is there, and I've got to where I read it that way.
My issue is I read it that way too, but most people are still distracted. So I think taking out the Hebrew and just having the dark and not overdoing it, and you get the gist of what's being said, and then you augment it. I think it's a much, much more effective way to communicate. So,
real quick question. Next Friday, we're with Scott. We're going to be in number 6, or we're continuing here?
We're continuing here.
Okay.
Yeah, we're continuing here. Oh, the other thing we still have is, of course, so we're going to go from here to Yashaya, Isaiah 1 and 2. And my hope is to eventually end up all the way at Yashaya 14. And I might be really old and really gray by the time I get there. that was my hope.
Well, you got something to keep you busy between now
Yashaya 1 and 2 bring up things like Magog, and they bring up things like Tarshish. We're able to talk about really interesting things, and it's all there laid out for us. So
Tarshish, didn't you say that had to do with the people doing international commerce by way of ships, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I think it's the 7th chapter. I've spent invested like 5 or 6 pages just drilling down on, okay, what do we know? What did God say about Tarshish? And who does it represent? And so I found the specific city. I found the empire that controlled them. I linked everything that they did to what God said about them. It's a perfect fit. The connection with the Phoenicians, the Punic Empire, the Carthaginian Empire, was founded by Phoenicians. Their metallurgy was what God says made them important, and it talked about each of the places they mined and that the fact they had an absolute exclusive on metal trades from all the way up from the British Isles all the way down to Nigeria. Everything in the Mediterranean, an absolute exclusive. And then it talks about their navies being the largest in the world and how the Navy existed specifically to facilitate its fleet of merchant ships in the trade specifically of metals, and how they were the first country to come up with a tangible monetary system just to support their trade. And so everything God says about the Carthaginians is fits into Tarshish, and the island, and the actual town was a city on Sardinia, which is an island off the coast of Rome. And so he goes through and he besmirches the merchants of Tarshish, and then but he's speaking of what he's going to do to them in the last days. And so what you have to do is understand what are the things that made Tarshish what he describes of them, and what country represents them today. Every aspect of the Carthaginian Empire is recreated in the United States. And so the ships.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, he only points to the U.S. about 50 times in his words, too. I mean,
yeah,
you know, I was thinking about that today as I was doing some. I was thinking about, you know, I've done a 180.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I used to be a patriot. I mean, really, I was willing to put it all out there, all of it.
Yeah.
Believe me when I tell you that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and now here I stand out here in total opposition. In opposition.
But, you know, I think that having been wrong and being passionate about being wrong provides us with a much more effective means of exposing and condemning what we formerly believed. We didn't, you know, it's not like we were communists and therefore all of our lives have been opposed to capitalism and therefore we're just finding what we were looking for in Yahweh's testimony and just applying it to what we always believed. What we found was the opposite of what we believed.
Yeah.
And right. So yeah. I mean, I was thinking in terms of the military and the U.S. Yeah. and the great Navy and all that. But, I mean, you know, here's
you
the
were
real
a Marine,
truth.
Right, Larry?
No,
I
wasn't.
I don't think I've
Marine.
Ever met more patriotic people than the Marines I know.
Yeah. Well, we used to train them. They were very good at shining shoes, was our perspective. You know,
bullet catchers.
Yeah, they were cannon fodder, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, if Babylon does its job, that's what people want to become, is a bullet catcher. You know that. That's the shtick. I mean, that is it. And everybody goes
for it. You can die for your country.
Or your religion.
I mean, well, you know, there's no greater love. It's that old story. You know, it's misquote after misquote, misconception after misconception. And this is how the whore wins. You know,
right.
I mean, this is how it operates. It's always the same. It's, you know, I mean, we sit here and we look at Yahweh saying, and so through trust and reliance, you know, those who are vindicated shall live. And then we got Sheol down here going, well, it's through faith in what I'm telling you, you know, and of course, you know, that's total arrogance, and it's totally wrong, and it's ass backwards. And faith has nothing, no part in reality, as we know. That's like having faith that you're going to go out there and beat that 25 cents an hour before you knew what you were doing. You know, it just doesn't happen that way.
Yeah.
And when it gets down to that, you're in trouble, buddy. I mean,
what faith typically does is it causes you to continue to do that which doesn't work.
Right.
Pursued a failed path. So rather than believe I could do the same thing and get a different result, I instead said, what can I do differently that might cause a different
really work
result?
Give me the 50 cents an hour.
Yeah, and give me the 50 cents an hour. No, and it said, okay, well, my talking is not getting it done. So what's the opposite of talking?
Listening. Let's try listening a bit.
Let's try that.
Make that every Yahweh, everybody. That works good, too.
Let's try that. Yeah, and it applies to Yahweh. You know, if we do a little listening, it might work. Pray without ceasing, that's Paul, or continually listen to and observe what I have to say. That's Yahweh.
Yeah, I don't know which way I'm going to go with.
The same shtick, isn't it? It's just like that. It's just, you know, you point that out, you know, in Bereshith. You know, he even had Chawa misquoting Yahweh.
Yeah.
Satan did. You know?
Correct.
And this is exactly what this is about. But because with regard to the Torah, absolutely no one is vindicated or justified by God because... becomes evident because those who are righteous out of faith will live. And then Yahweh says the exact opposite.
Right.
So then through trust and reliance, those who are righteous and vindicated shall live. Through trust and reliance, got nothing to do with faith. It's got to do with what you know.
In the context of condemning Pauline Christianity, he says the answer is trust and reliance.
And then Emuna and Amun.
Emuna. Yeah, Emuna and Amun, yeah.
Trust in Amun.
Right.
There's no faith in there.
No.
I agree. I mean, you know, is it, you know, you there's things, there's thousands of things we've learned.
Yeah, there
thousands. And, yeah. I mean,
yeah,
we can't sit here for the next 15 hours be amazed at what all we've learned in the last 10 years.
We sit on top of a mountain of jewels.
I know.
A mountain of jewels.
I mean, don't you feel like that when you go somewhere? You're like the only guy with any real knowledge. I mean, I really feel that way.
I do.
I don't mean to be arrogant. I just feel that way.
No,
because I know it's true.
You know, listen,
I feel like
there
lucky
is
guy.
A pride that comes
that's pretty
from being associated with Yahweh, from knowing Yahweh,
yep.
from knowing the Torah, from understanding who he is and what he's offering. There is a sense of real satisfaction. There's a confidence. There is a sense of purpose. There is a... you know, I mean, I'm proud to be part of Yahweh's family.
That's a way to put it.
I am proud to be Torah observant.
And you notice everybody around you is talking just a lot of BS that doesn't even matter.
Correct.
I mean, that's all you ever hear.
Right.
I can just flip on the nightly news.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, there's no part of associating with Yahweh that I'm not proud of. I'm proud to know him.
I got to tell you, you know, you're always talking about, you know, I'm not the sharpest guy in the whatever.
Yeah,
well, you're up there, pal.
Yeah, you're pretty sharp.
You know, it's...
you're up there, pal.
It is.
When I'm the first part volition and, you know, this and that, yeah, you know, you got my head spinning over here. You know that, right? I mean, you do know that. And I'm sitting here going, what did he just say? What did... and you know the beauty of it?
The first person volition is really just the cohortative, and when Yahweh uses it as a mood, he's expressing his will. It's pretty astounding to think that Hebrew as a language has the following elements to it that aren't found in any other language. One is that its verbs are infinite in time, and no Hebrew verb is ever stuck in time. So that the Hebrew terminology reflects Yahweh's energy nature. That's profound. That most Hebrew verbs,
especially when you go with Yahweh's name, and the basis of it is existence. I mean, that right there,
that's
the shoulders above
when
anything.
The Hebrew verbs are scribed with a stem, and every stem establishes a relationship between the subject and the object of the action. And when you realize that everything Yahweh was talking about is a relationship between him and us, and he created a language where every verb is ascribed a relationship between the subject and the object. Perfect. For a relationship purpose. And then he has, in the auspices of free will, giving us the choice, he has a language that has moods, and every one of the moods reflects volition, choice. And then, since he doesn't have verbs that are ever stuck in time, he has verbs that express action that is either completed in the future or in the past, or action that is ongoing. And so, specifically, he can tell you that, Larry, if you're imperfect, I can resolve that.
Well, good for... That's good. That's
yeah,
a good thing.
I can resolve that.
Where I'm coming from.
Yeah. I can perfect the imperfect. And so, every instruction that he gives us about things we ought not do, it's always written in the imperfect. You know, don't make a habit of bearing false witness. Don't make a habit of being religious. Don't make that part of your ongoing behavior. So the moment you stop, you're good to go. What a marvelous language to have all of those attributes. And then
you know,
to have that language conveyed in letters that paint pictures.
Right,
so you can
and
affirm
it's the roughest the thing. That's the roughest thing. That's what we always fight. You know, when people first step into the covenant, they believe me, they fall right in love with the fact there's no command and obey structure.
Right. Yeah. Correct.
It's actually fun to watch. It's fun
it
to
is.
Watch. I'm sure
oh,
you've
it's
seen
so
it.
It's so liberating.
You
know? It's so releasing. It's so empowering and invigorating to be in an environment where there is
freedom.
Teaching and guidance.
Freedom.
And total and complete freedom.
Yeah,
and even when you're in one of the great finds we came across was the fact that that we're going to have Torah inscribed inside of us for eternity, which means that we have the freedom to go off and explore and do, but yet the guidance is to something stupid.
And that's pretty thing up.
Right.
Yeah, like getting sucked into the black hole thing.
Yeah, I might be sucked into the black hole.
Yeah, and that's because we've made a decision from the start. I mean, if Yahweh comes up and tells me something, you better believe I'm going to believe it.
I'm going to listen. It, you know? Right, I'm going to listen.
I'm going to actually follow that instruction.
Well, you know, it's not a violation of free will if we are asking for him to do it.
Right. Well, correct.
Yeah, you know,
well,
if we choose,
right. If we choose to listen to him and act upon what he has said, that's still an expression of free will. Listen. I'm looking forward to exploring the universe with him and apart from him. And when I'm apart from him, I want to make certain that what I'm doing is consistent with what he thinks is in our best interest to do, so that when we come back together to celebrate the Shabbat, each week as we explore, what I share is going to be relevant and not stupid. You know, I'll go off and do something that's stupid. And come back, you know, to the meeting and say, oh, there's that win again. Why is he an idiot?
I got it. No. Actually, you know, I had a friend that was the retired NCO of the Air Force. Really, I mean, you know, you got 100 generals, but, you know, you have 100,000 enlisted guys or more, and you only have one NCO of them.
Right.
And, you know, I'm telling you that... we went to watch space shuttle liftoffs, and we got our asses kissed by two-star generals. Jim McCoy is his name.
Yeah.
And he was one of the smartest men I ever met. And after I had, you know, gotten to know you and saw what you were sharing and so forth, I said, this guy's the smartest guy I know. I mean, really. I mean, I don't mean to... The last thing I am is an apple polisher or ass kiss or anything like that. I'm not. When I say something like this, I mean it. So, you know,
when you study Yahweh's Torah, you can't help but get smart.
Yeah, that makes you smart. Smarter than everyone else around, actually. No other way around.
It's the source of instruction. You know, if your teacher is the smartest being in the universe and you're willing to listen to that teacher,
and repeat,
and you're open to what that teacher has to say, and you enjoy understanding the teacher, based on that alone, how could you avoid being reasonably smart? And by the way, who are you being compared to? I mean, we're compared to morons that believe that Paul spoke for God. I mean, by comparison to the idiots, okay, you know. We're certainly not claiming to be smarter than God. We're claiming that we are smarter than the average idiot out there because we've listened to God.
Yeah.
That's a reasonable
thing. Yeah.
That's reasonable.
I'm reading something from Melissa Williams here. It says, a real man never hurts a woman. I agree with that. Be careful. You make a woman cry because God counts her tears. The woman came out of a man's rib. And that's where I had to say, actually, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Why do they make these stories up?
Yeah, I mean, the first part of that's true enough.
First part of it's true.
Yeah. Now it's not. Is it 100% always true? No. You know, a Muslim woman is despicable. It's just despicable. And if a Muslim woman is out there professing Islam and is creating an environment where Islamic suicide bombers can become more successful, then, you know, I want to stop her.
I'd have to tell you, I've met some very, very, very sweet Shia women, and I promise you, they'll do more for you. They don't believe the Quran, by the way.
No,
they're not out doing this stuff. They're not Islamic.
So they're really not Muslims. They're really not Muslims.
Well, they're not good Muslims.
Yeah, they're not Muslims by the Quran's definition.
No, they're not.
You can't be a good person and be a Muslim by the Quran's definition. But you can claim to be a Muslim and actually not be a Muslim by the Quran's definition and still be a decent person.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's probably what I'm talking about here.
Yeah.
I found them to be far more giving, and this is just my take. And more decent people than Christians, and more honest too. And that's what I found. faith. I know that that shocks you.
That's not, but again, that's not saying much.
Well, that ain't saying much, is it? The biggest thieves I had, the last guy stole an engine from me, his email was, what was it, something for Christ. It was unbelievable.
Yeah,
right.
Thief,
of course.
The worst people I ever met in business were Mormons. By far.
I believe it.
Yeah. Even Jerry Falwell, you know, the founder of Thomas Road Baptist Church and the Moral Majority and all that kind of stuff, Liberty University, he said specifically that if he was hiring somebody to work on his on the church or the university, and they were a professing Christian and they said, let's pray about it, he knew that he'd get screwed. And he said it happened every time. He says, I want to do business with a guy who is not going to
Thinks he protests too loudly.
I would always choose to do business with a person who is not religious, because the person who is religious, I can't. That's what God said.
Don't you know that's true? That's
Of course it's true. Yeah, they're all
It's been my pleasure, but I just don't see Craig as the stupidest guy out there. He might be the smartest.
He does spend a lot of time with a really smart teacher.
There you go. I believe. I mean, you know, being smarter than the rest of us, what do you think, Kirk? It don't mean all that
much.
Yeah,
don't mean pretty quick.
If you saw how long it takes me to get a chapter where I'm comfortable with it and to do translations, you wouldn't think that very very fast. But anyway, it's fun. Guys,
I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Happy to see
all you guys.
Always a good time.
Always a good time. Good night, everybody.
Good night, Jody.
Bye-bye.